Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. On this episode, our theme is Wisdom from Our Elders. We'll hear stories about Alaska from back in the day. First, we'll hear from Betty Arnett. Betty says her bit of wisdom is, don't do what Betty did.
In 1952, I was 22 years old in Seattle, climbing aboard the SS Aleutian that was making its final trip or last voyage up to Alaska. And I was headed to Seward because I was about to become the mother to 11 little boys in the Jesse Lee home. So when I got on the ship, I looked around for somebody my age. And what I saw was a sea of old people. Why, I hadn't seen a soul under the age of 50. So I began to look around, and you know, some of those people, the old people, were absolutely surprised that a young woman would go to Alaska to live. Well, sure, go up to visit, but to live? They just couldn't imagine such a thing. Well, I kept looking through the ship until I found a woman my age, and there she was with two handsome sailors. She said, "Hi, we're looking for people our age, and it looks like you're it. Would you like to join us?" Oh, were they a sight for sore eyes. Well, introductions were made, and I learned that they were members of the Coast Guard headed up to Ketchikan for their next assignment. And I also learned that one of the sailors was married to the young lady. And the other sailor said to me, "I saw you coming aboard. We looked for you in the dining room. Where were you sitting?" Well, unfortunately, I had been assigned a different hour. "Ah, we'll get that changed," said the young woman. "Really? Do you think the purser would change it?" "Oh, sure he will," said her husband. "Tell you what, first thing in the morning, right after breakfast, we'll go, all of us, and talk to him." And from that moment on, the Coast Guard and I were inseparable. We played cards, we danced, we sang, we laughed. And oh yes, the unattached sailor and I even romanced. We lost track of time as we strolled the decks of the Aleutian long after everybody else had gone to bed. Well, we knew that our time was short because Ketchikan was the first stop going up there. So you see, the married couple sensed that there was something growing between us, and so they kind of gave us time to be alone. Now, the night before we were to get into Ketchikan, the sailor looked at me and he said, "You know, when I saw you come aboard, I thought you were a ballerina. I never would have guessed you're a missionary." Well, I blushed, thinking that that was a compliment. And he said, hey, you know, sometimes the Coast Guard goes up to Seward. And, well, I'll try and pull that duty, and then you and I can see each other again. Oh, please do. I'd like that very much. Promise me you'll try? And then he looked lovingly into my eyes, and he said, I will. And then he was kissing me like I had never been kissed before. Oh, if this was love, I was in it. And his wooing became, well, more progressive. And it was all I could do to keep from resisting him. And mixed emotions were welling up inside of me, but my head kept a firm hand on the desires of my body. You idiot! You can't fall in love with him. For goodness sakes, you may never see him again. You're a missionary about to make a 3-year term. Reason with him. Well, he wasn't in much of a mood for reasoning. But, well, we were bewitched, both of us. And then he stopped, and he looked at me, and he said, I have to ask you something. At first, I thought you knew, but now I don't think you've ever known. Known what? Well, the night we met, did you notice I was wearing a wedding band? No. Are you trying to tell me you're married? Well, yes, but my wife and I are thinking about getting a divorce. Oh, my heart sank. Where's your ring now? Why aren't you wearing it? It's back in the cabin. You see, I took it off that morning after we had met, and well, you know, we were having so much fun, I was afraid it would make a difference. Does it? I had no idea you were married. You know it makes a difference. Where I come from in Tennessee, this is all wrong. And of course, the thought that was flooding my head was, this is definitely behavior unbecoming to a missionary. So I gently pushed him away, and I said, I'm sorry, but I must go to my cabin. And I never saw him again. But you know, later on I did marry a sailor, but it wasn't him.
Here's another story from a longtime Alaskan. Former Anchorage Mayor Jack Roderick came to live in Anchorage in 1954. We'll hear a slice of life from his early days.
What Anchorage was like 60 years ago. You've heard that the only two roads paved downtown were the 4th and 5th, which is true. And then we get our mail at the post office, which is in the federal building there on 4th and F. And that was nice. It gave you a feeling of a small community. You'd meet somebody usually in the morning that you either knew or had a nodding acquaintance with, and it was really quite nice. Down where the museum now is was a baseball park. It sat about 200 people, I'd say. Adlai Stevenson came up here running against Ike. And I remember sitting there, and I think Vic said he was there too. And Adlai said, what is this word I keep hearing? Outside. Do you think you people are inside something? And a matter of fact, I sat there and I had a warm feeling. Yeah, that's right. That's what I felt. I was in this great, big, wonderful land, not physically connected to the U.S., and I could do, maybe it was me, I think it was most of the Alaskans, I could do anything I wanted. Of course, statehood was the thing we were looking for at that point. But a couple years later, at Swanson River down on the Kenai, we, the state, I'm sorry, it wasn't a state yet, we found the first commercial oil in Alaska. That was a big, big deal. And this town was just swarmed with oil people. Most of them were landmen because you have to have land in order to drill. But there were a lot of companies, new companies. Actually, Exxon and BP came up for the first time. And I suckered in too, and I got bit by the bug, and I leased to, in the first year, 20 million acres of federal land were leased down the chain, of course, Cook Inlet, Copper River. And then, of course, a couple years later, a year and a half later, we had statehood. So at that point, us little guys, us people that came up for whatever reason, we became important as far as politics was concerned. We finally could vote for our president and elect two senators and one congressperson. 1964, Martha and I had bought and lived in a shack at the end of the park strip, overlooking the water. And I say a shack because it was a shack. At night in the wintertime, the inside of our bedroom would freeze. And our two kids lived up in the attic. And I was putting my skis on the car down in Alyeska when the earth started to shake. Martha was in the house, and the kids were up in the loft. So she put her hands out of both the walls and stood there hoping that she wouldn't have to catch one of the kids. She stood there for five minutes, as you know. My oldest daughter, Sarah, went to school at Inlet View and told her classmates and her teacher that her mom held up the house. The other tragic during the earthquake was that Fourth Avenue, the north side, that Bob Hope had called the longest bar in the world, it went down, which was a tragedy. Fast forward to 72. By that time, we had discovered the two largest oil fields in North America. The natives had finally been given the land that they had deserved. And the oil guys were ready now to start construction. So I remember vaguely standing in my living room, looking out at the Westchester Lagoon, where I still live. And I was maligning some politician, probably Mike Gravel, because he was one of my clients when I was practicing. And Martha and my brother, who was counsel for the railroad at the time, they both simultaneously, I think, said, "Jack, we're tired of you maligning politicians. If you think you can make it better or different, why don't you run for office?" Well, it just so happened that the chairman of the borough, John Ashland, had decided not to run. So 11 of us, all guys, decided to run and put our names in. Well, Martha and I knew that we were going to have to do some television spots, so we hired a television guy. And I think you'll hear Lainey Fleischer later, after me, I think, And I'm sure we took a shot of her trails, and I was in favor of that kind of thing. So Martha and I started to go door to door. And Martha loved to tell this story. She'd knock on the door, and the person would come, and they'd say, "Oh, we're going to vote for your husband." And Martha, being a better politician than me, she was on the school board and the chairman of it, she would say, "Why?" And they'd say, "Oh, the dog." "The dog? Oh, yeah, the dog on TV." Well, this photographer of ours told us he had another 100 feet of film, so why don't we get out, the four of us get out there and play badminton, which we did. And as the shuttlecock would come over, our little black and white dog, Jamie, sitting there, would look at it back and forth, wagging his tail. It was... So without our knowledge, the people who took care of animals up here all told their friends and probably wrote letters saying, "Well, we don't know if this guy Roderick is going to be a good mayor, but at any rate, he's a good guy, and he likes animals, particularly dogs." Of the 11 people who ran, I came out number one, but like a couple of weeks ago, we had a runoff, and I beat a guy whose name, I'm sorry, I've forgotten. No, really, really, I wrote it down. So maybe to end this before the guys throw me out of here, imagine, if you will, what you'd like Anchorage to be like 60 years from now. You could do it. You could make the difference. Thank you.
That was Jack Roderick, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Now we'll hear from Anchorage's first planning director. Here's Vic Fisher, who was also a delegate to Alaska's Constitutional Convention.
76 years ago this month, around the time of my 15th birthday, I was at the White House having dinner with the President and the First Lady of the United States. It was the beginning of my experience with the third type of government in the world, democracy, and an opening of the doors to what I became in Alaska in the decades to come. As a kindergartner in Moscow, I was being inculcated already with Lenin's Marxism and communism at a time when there was famine, disease, horrible living conditions characterizing Russia. In the following 2 years, I lived in Berlin and saw Hitler's rise to power. My second father, in quotes, was arrested when the fascists came to power in 1933, and he was tortured. I despised fascism. Back in Moscow, Stalin was consolidating his hold on power and moved toward the beginning of the horrendous period of terror in Russia. This was not an abstract concept. It was very close to home. My best friend's father was arrested. His mother lost her job. They were thrown out of their apartment, which, as all housing, was controlled by the state. The mother and sister moved in with another family. My friend stayed with us. In fairly short order, word came that the father had been executed. In my school, most of my classmates lost a parent in the Purges, or some very close relative. One night, I heard the heavy stomping of KGB boots coming up the stairs of our apartment building. In short order, there was a horrendous pounding on the door next to ours. In the morning, our neighbors were gone, their place empty. In our large housing complex, two-thirds of the apartments were vacated and re-rented to security forces members. It was a horrendous time. There was terror, fear, and the repression grew ever worse. My father, an American foreign correspondent in Moscow, in Russia, went to Spain in 1936 to cover the Spanish Civil War and participate in it, and then return to the United States. My mother, a Russian citizen, was a translator, and as the wife of a foreigner, she could no longer find work in Russia. Her friends were being arrested, and she lived in fear for herself and her family. She eventually applied to receive an exit visa so she and her two sons could join our father in America. The answer was a long time a coming, and when she was called to the passport office, I went with her. Boy. The answer was a refusal to allow the family to leave Russia. My mother was devastated. She broke out in tears. I took her arm and walked her out of the building. I was 14. My father was in New York at the time, and he knew of the situation, and he knew that my mother was in danger of being arrested any day, in which case my brother and I, both American citizens by birth, could be sent to a remote children's camp. He knew that only high-level intercession could save his family. He contacted Eleanor Roosevelt with a message that asked her to see him for a personal, an urgent personal problem. She immediately responded and invited him to the White House. They had known each other previously when she visited her earlier at the White House to discuss the U.S. neutrality policies in connection with the Spanish Civil War. She acted then as a conduit to the president for my father. At this point, she immediately invited my father to come to the White House. She received him and quickly understood what the situation was, and she was particularly concerned about the two boys being within years of being drafted into the Russian army. She shared the situation with the president, and in short order, Moscow was informed that the president personally wanted the Fisher family to be released to come to the United States. Within 2 weeks, my mother, brother, and I were out of Russia. Mrs. Roosevelt invited us to dinner in May 1939. She met us at the door. FDR joined us at the dining table. It was the beginning of my experience with democracy, and it opened the doors for my future in Alaska. As an American citizen, I was able to decide on my own life what and where it would be.
That was Vic Fisher, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Rosie Robards.
And I'm Jason Brandeis.
Our next storyteller is known as the mother of the Anchorage Trail System.
She moved to Alaska in 1971, thinking she would only be here temporarily. But Alaska and Anchorage firmly captured her heart. Here's Lainey Fleischer.
Well, we got off the ferry at Haines, started down the road for Anchorage, and the first thing we saw was a wolf trotting down the road. Well, of course we saw a wolf. I expected a wolf. We were in Alaska. Of course, I didn't see a wolf again for about 30 years. But and then as we were driving a couple of days later into Anchorage, I see people traveling by dog team. Well, of course, I expected to see people traveling by dog team. I thought that's how people got around in Alaska. Then I found out that we had arrived in the middle of for a rendezvous. But the one thing that I expected to see that I did not see were trails. I don't know why, but I just had this vision, I had this expectation that people in Alaska used trails and got around by trails. And so I made a nuisance of myself. Every time I met somebody, I'm running around saying, why don't you have trails? Why don't you have a network of trails? And people would say, well, that's a good idea. Why don't you do something about that? I thought, me? I just got here. But I kept doing that and talking about it, and then I ran into John Reese, and he said, that is a good idea. He said, you should do something about that, and I'll help. And so we launched the effort to convince the community that they needed a network of trails. And what we did is we put a little ad in the paper saying that anybody who's interested in seeing a network of trails in Anchorage, come on down to the park strip for a bike day, and we'll have a bike in, and we'll have a bike parade. And about 1,000 people showed up. Well, it seemed like 1,000. It was a lot. A lot of people showed up. And so we started on our crusade to get trails. And we made this big map, and we put all these trails everywhere on the map. And we particularly paid attention to neighborhoods, though we were trying to connect all the neighborhoods because we thought that kids should be able to ride their bikes to school or to parks. And so we had trails. We even had trails going down the railroad right-of-way. It shows you how much we knew. But anyway, so we took this map and we went to meetings. There were lots and lots of meetings going on then because Anchorage was in the throes of planning a highway system, and they had hired the people who planned the Los Angeles freeways to come up here and plan the Anchorage freeways. And really, I kid you not, there were clover leaves. There was a clover leaf, I remember, for sure, in the UMed district would have been a big clover leaf, but other places. But so we took our map with all our trails and went to all the highway hearings and said trails should be part of the transportation plan, and that this is, you know, what we really need, so that people could commute by bike, or they could go to, so the kids could get around without being in a car. Well, we had so many meetings going on that my kids, instead of playing house, played go to meeting. But so we're taking this map everywhere. And I was testifying before the city council. This was before unification. And the mayor of the city at that point said, I was talking about the fact that we should have a trail from the mountains to the inlet. And he looked at me and he said, young lady, I was really young then, do you know how far that is? And I didn't, but it looked feasible to me. And he said, nobody's going to ride a bike that far. So that was our big obstacle. We had to convince the powers that be that trails were a feasible idea, because they really thought people wouldn't get around by bikes. And it was such a foreign idea that actually we had a half-hour television program. In those days, you got public service programs. We were given a half an hour to show this newfangled idea of a 10-speed. And we had 10 speeds on the set. We lifted up the 10 speeds to show people how lightweight they were. And here's how the gears worked. And it was, in fact, feasible with these 10 speeds to bike long distances. And we had two young women who came on who had just gotten back from a bike trip to Kodiak Island, and they had gone 30 miles. So we kept taking our map everywhere and preaching trails everywhere. And finally, 2 years later, this community passed a bond issue for the first bike trail. And right, 2 years, and we got a bond issue. And so Lee Browning from the city called me into his office after the bond issue passed, and he said, now the mayor doesn't want to spend any money on trails until the bonds are sold and the money is in the bank. But don't worry, I've got all the contracts ready to go, and the minute that check hits my hand, we're going to go, and I think we'll get a trail done before the snow falls this year. And that's what he did. But then he said, so where should we build the first trail? Chester Creek, of course. We have to have Chester Creek. I just felt that the trail along Chester Creek would be so wonderful that it would sell the idea of the trail system. Okay, Chester Creek, but now there's a small problem, is we don't have enough money. We can do the asphalt from the lagoon to Goose Lake, but we don't have enough money for the tunnel under the Seward Highway and that whole distance. So I said, that's okay. Lay the asphalt to Gamble, and then on the other side of Gamble-Ingra, lay the asphalt from Ingra to Goose Lake. And I think after a couple of seasons of watching us trail users scramble up the side and across the highway in the middle of traffic and down, I think we'll get our tunnels. And of course we did. So that first trail was built, the Chester Creek Trail, September 1973. And as soon as it was done, a group of us rode our bikes out to Goose Lake from the lagoon, and yes, we pushed our bikes up the embankment, across the highway, down the other side. When we got out to Goose Lake, there were these kids splashing around in the lake. They were bicycles thrown in the sand, and they were stomping around in the lake with shoes and clothes and everything, and they were having so much fun. And I said something to them. I don't remember what I said, but I remember what they said. They said, we never knew this was here. Look, we followed this trail, and we came here, and there's a lake here. I know. I started to cry. I thought, oh, my God, it works.
You're listening to Arctic Entries on KSK Anchorage. That was Lainey Fleischer.
Our next storyteller, Lisa Dolchuk, was born in the Bristol Bay region and currently works as a tribal doctor and elder advisor at South Central Foundation.
Chamai!
Chamai!
Thank you, Rihanna. In 1947, around the middle of May, the ice had gone down the Nooshigak River, so my family was preparing to go downriver to Ekok to commercial fish. And an airplane landed with pontoons, And it was territorial days, and it was a marshal. He came into the house, and as children, we lined up, my uncle, myself, and a sister. And he pointed at me and asked my mother, "How old is this girl?" My mom said, "She'll be 9 in November." He says, "Well, she needs to be in school." And as I'm standing there like this, I didn't know what school was. I could count to 10. And we all spoke broken English. And after he left, I said, "Mom, what is that?" She said, "Well, your dad will tell you when he comes in." Anyway, we went fishing. And at the end of it, he had also told my mother, "I'm coming back here to this cabin in September. And if you and your family are here, your husband will go to jail. Your daughter has to go to school." So that fall, we went to Clark's Point. It was a bigger village, so it had a school built there. And I had to braid my hair. My mom braided my hair. I had to wear stockings. I was a tomboy. I had to wear a dress, laced up shoes, brush my teeth. And the teacher was taking roll call, and I didn't know my legal name was Elizabeth. My grandma named me Elisa Kinyupik, and I heard Elizabeth Lopez. And I'm looking around, who has my last name? My cousin Morris behind me said, "That's you, you're supposed to say here." And I turned and said, "What for? I'm here." I got in trouble. I had to go stand in a corner. And when I got back, you know, it was a long day of sitting still. I opened my desk, I lifted the cover. I knew pencil and paper, and there was this pretty box. So I opened it and shook it out. I didn't know what they were, so I took each one and I bit into it. And the girl said, "Those are crayons, you're not supposed to eat it." And at recess, we went out, and because my cousin and I were almost 9 years old, we were big for first grade. So these kids were poking fun, and they formed a circle around me, and they were going, "Ooh, ooh, ooh, ooh." It was the first time in my life I didn't want to laugh with them. So next morning, I pretended to be sick, like I had a tummy ache. My dad went to the cupboard and got the cod liver oil and a tablespoon. Fastest recovery. But a couple days later, he said, "Come on, let's go check the net." And there was a big rock on that beach, and he sat me down, and he did something he's never done to me before. He said, "Look at me." In my Yupik world, we're taught to stand like this, and we never look at adults eye to eye. It was really hard. I looked at his eyebrow. He said, "No, look at me. So why did you pretend to be sick and don't want to go to school?" I said. I told him what happened, and he said, "Lisa," he drew two circles in the sand, and he made me stand 1 foot in each. He said, "You've learned everything in your mother's world, in the native world, to prepare you for this world. And now you have to learn mine. It's a white man's way, and you have to learn it. You have to speak better English. You have to watch to see how people do things so you do it right." Did I understand him? No. I was 8 and a half years old. And he pulled up his sleeve and he held it next to mine and he said, "Three things, Lisa. Number one, you're brown. Number two, you're a girl, and you're half-breed. You're part Native and you're part Filipino. So life is not going to be easy." Years later, we come to Anchorage. My son was in kindergarten, 69. He came home from school and he said, "Mom, I have a joke." He said, "My mama Chinese. My daddy Japanese, poor me." And his lips were trembling, and he said, "Mama, I didn't want to laugh." So I either had to teach him anger, But no, I had to do like my father. I said, they don't know you. You don't look Native, you don't look white, you don't look Chinese. So you're poor me, Kriana.
Thank you for your story, Lisa Dolchuk. This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Now we'll hear from civic entrepreneur Eleanor Andrews. Andrews tries to inspire institutions, businesses, and individuals to invest in their communities.
She's an LA girl who found a home in Alaska. Here's Eleanor.
So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about me. I was going to talk about how I got to be an Alaskan. Came up here in 65 to get to know my father, who had divorced my mother when I was just a year old. And it was quite an awakening. I'll just draw a few contrasts for you. In LA, we had smog. In Fairbanks, you had ice fog. In LA, you had three major networks and lots of TV. In Fairbanks, we had one TV station that was on whenever it worked. It was just unbelievable. I couldn't even complain about it because it was all so stark and so new. So my husband, my one-year-old son, and I came up March 1965, and I waited until March because I thought it would be springtime. And I didn't have any appropriate clothing. I had a white crushed leather, quotes, faux vinyl coat. And by the time winter was over, my coat broke. Every place I bent, sat down, tried to button it or tie the waist, it just broke. And so by summer, I had these flutters that were only stuck to the coat because they were at the seams. Those and my patent leather high heel go-go boots just did not work in Fairbanks, Alaska. So 1965 summer was great. I had a baby in November. I'd been to the doctor that day and I said, I'm feeling something. He said, oh no, you got two more weeks. So I went home and 2 hours later, I was in labor. My water broke. Found my husband, take me to the hospital. I outweighed him at that time. He couldn't get me up in the truck. So we had to call a cab. And all the way to the hospital, I'm groaning. My feet are hanging out the door or the window. And the cab driver kept stopping. I said, keep going. He said, you're screaming. I said, I'm having a baby. And so we finally made it to the hospital. Frank couldn't get me out because I was laying across him. My father comes up. He'd heard I was on the way to the hospital. Picks me, my coat, up with the baby in my coat. Lays me on the floor of St. Joseph's Hospital. I don't think they had an emergency department. It was just the reception area. And my doctor, Dr. Rebar, happened to be coming out putting on his gloves. And he said, why, Eleanor, what are you doing here? I said, I'm having this baby I'm supposed to have in 2 weeks. So they took me upstairs, took care of the baby, had me in a room with a crazy lady who kept reaching across saying, don't let them send me home to Eldred. I did not make this name up, I remember it. I said, who's Eldred? He's my husband. He wouldn't bring me to the hospital because he was hanging sheetrock. He kept saying, just hold up this last panel. I'll nail it up, and when I'm done, we can go to the hospital. She was hysterical. So I called in the nurse, who kind of looked like Nurse Ratched. She couldn't calm this lady, so she put her in restraints, and they put me in a bed out in the hallway, which I was glad. So it was a very active night. I watched lots of things. So in the morning, my doctor came by and said, how you doing? I said, I'm ready to go. So he released me, went home. My dad was at the house with my son, spraying his diaper because it was kind of stinky and loaded, and with Lysol. So I changed him, went to the laundromat, and just kept on with my life. So that was 1965 in November. December was our first Christmas. I'd had dreams of a white Christmas my whole life. Never seen snow before. So we didn't know where to get a Christmas tree because, you know, the Fairbanks black spruce are not real pretty. And they weren't selling them in the store. So we took ladders, my father's scaffolding, climbed up to the top of this tree, whacked off about 6 feet, brought it in the house. I strung popcorn. I made construction paper loops, put them on the tree. I had made myself a new robe, my husband and my son, little smoking jacket kind of things, took our picture. Oh, and I had the the one-month-old baby. And we made hot chocolate, went to bed, got up the next morning, and all the needles had fallen off the tree. Every single one of them. So I had this Charlie Brown wire hanger looking Christmas tree. We just kind of scooped the needles up for a few more days for the aroma, then we got rid of Christmas. So 1966 was pretty uneventful. 67 was pretty much the same until August. That's quick. We had a flood. I was stuck in an apartment with 14 other people for a couple of weeks. Most of them didn't know or like each other. When the water went down, we hopped in our little hoopty Chevy truck, found another place to live, which was a log building in downtown Fairbanks, mucked it out, laid down floor, went to Army Surplus and got a stove and a refrigerator. We had no sink. I was washing dishes one night in the shower in the bathroom, look over, and there was this giant mushroom growing on the wall. It scared me to death. So I ran down to Safeway in my bunny boots and coat, got a paper, found an apartment, and we moved the next day. And we had a very uneventful life for the last 8-9 months I was in Fairbanks. My husband finished school in April, got a job offer from IBM, and here we're driving down the road. I felt like the Clampets coming to Beverly Hills. We had a ratty old Rambler, which we had thought was a dry car. What the dealers in Fairbanks did was took all the cars to Anchorage, cleaned them up, brought them back to Fairbanks, and sold them to us. So my first day in Anchorage, I dropped my husband at the truck stop, had a shower and a shave, took him to IBM. I found Spinard Kitty Drop, dropped my kids there. And by noon, I had a place for us at the Anchorage Inn at 8th and 9th and D. And that's how I became an Alaskan.
That was Eleanor Andrews, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our theme is Wisdom from Our Elders, Stories from Alaska Back in the Day.
Next up is Phil Morrow. He was an Army brat born in New York who's been living in Alaska since 1956.
As you might know, Anchorage and Alaska were far different back in the 50s. As an idea, 4th and 5th Avenue were the only paved streets in town. 4th Avenue actually had curbs and gutter and sidewalks for a ways. 5th Avenue was strip paved down the middle with gravel on the sides, and the Northern Commercial Company's Caterpillar Tractor Repair Shop was in the building that Orso Restaurant now is in. So, arriving here with a brand new degree in geology, I didn't have any trouble getting a job with the Corps of Engineers, known throughout the territory in those days as the district, because we were the Alaska district of the Corps, and got sent all over the territory. There's no way I could have afforded the airfare to the places they sent me. As an example of what it was like, I carried my field gear in a GI duffel bag, and the handle of that duffel bag got so covered with strings from pulling off the baggage tags that you couldn't even see the handle itself. It was just all strings. Well, Anchorage, there were very few regulations in those days. The town itself was pretty calm, but the right outside of the city limits, there were places like Fort Stearns out on 5th Avenue, and where Post Road, where 4th Avenue turns down to Post Road, there were B-girl joints. And the reason for that is the territorial legislature had passed a statute because of the fact that construction contractors had a habit of leaving town without paying their workers. So they were required by law to pay them in cash every Saturday. And there's many a construction worker that started back into town and didn't make it past those B-girl joints before he was stripped of all his money. Well, one particular project that I was on was out at ADAC, where we were going to put in a new antenna for a radar. Well, Harry and I, Harry was a GS-11, I was a GS-9. So we went out by way of Revolution Airlines, and You had to stop at Cold Bay in those days and spend overnight in their hotel. Well, when we finally got out to ADAC, we billeted, got into our rooms, went out, looked over the site, and by then it was dinner time. So we went over to the officers' mess. The Navy had a pretty formal officers' mess with linen tablecloths, napkin rings, and Filipino stewards to serve you. Well, we got to the door, and I had worn a tweed jacket like this with this particular bolo tie, whereas Harry carried, he wore his field clothes and checked the survey equipment and the excavating equipment. So he got to the door, and he wasn't allowed entry. Had to have a jacket and tie to get into the officer's mess. So he went over to the CPO mess. Well, he wasn't allowed in there because he was an officer grade level. So he couldn't eat that night. I had to smuggle out food to him. I got some rolls and butter and folded them up in a napkin and took them out. It was a little better for breakfast because I could put some bacon in between pieces of toast. But it was pretty late in the day before we got back to our headquarters. Communication wasn't as good in those days, and got him permission to eat in a contractor's tent. Well, I don't know what the moral to this story is, but there must be one.
That was Phil Morrow live on the Arctic Entry stage in May 2015.
Here's Governor Bill Walker to close out our show. Born in Fairbanks and raised in Delta Junction and Valdez, his parents were Alaskan pioneers.
And this story takes place in December 15th of 1969. I need to set up a little bit who's in the story. One person is Marty Rutherford. Marty is a classmate of mine since fourth grade in Valdez. She's Deputy Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources. She's now the lead negotiator for the state of Alaska on the gas line. So she's done very well, and I'm proud to have her as my lead negotiator. Willie Schmidt was a classmate of ours in Valdez, and he was, you'll see how Willie plays into this story. So in Valdez, growing up in Valdez, sports, there were three things really important in Valdez: sports, sports, and sports. You had to be on the team. You had to travel. It was a really big deal. Marty was a cheerleader. I was on the team, so we made the traveling team. And so when we got out of high school, graduated in 69, it was just a big, we were still sort of immersed in that whole high school sports, just still loved it. We went off to college for the first semester, and we came back, and it was just Marty and myself had come back by now, because others were coming back a little bit later. And so we got back about the 15th of December, and Willie Schmidt was there, and he had not gone, as I recall. So there was a basketball tournament in Delta Junction. Those who don't know, Valdez to Delta Junction is about 256 miles. We decided, let's go to the basketball tournament. There's still a lot of people we know from basketball, and we just kind of like immerse ourselves a little bit back into the high school day, and we'd only been out for less than a year. So we decided to go to Delta. Of course, in those days, it was not the land a time of you know, two or three vehicles. Everybody had one vehicle. We couldn't find a vehicle that we could drive from. Of course, it was 25 below in Delta, and so we couldn't find a vehicle to drive. And I tried with my family and Marty, her father John Kelsey, one of the founders of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. He's on the board forever. He wasn't going to donate a car for us to drive to Delta at 20 below. So we said, well, how about Willie? Let's get Willie. Willie Schmidt will do it. His folks will let us use the station wagon. How many have heard the word station wagon for a while? I mean, just not. Anyway, let's start with that. We got the family station wagon in Willie's car, and we take off for Delta. And as we're driving along, and we knew the car wasn't, you know, in a small town like that, you know everybody's, everything about everybody. We knew that station wagon wasn't the best station wagon, but it was fine. And heater worked. Off we go, and every 100 miles, we kind of lose another gear. I was like, that's kind of a problem. But we made it to Delta. We went up. We went to the basketball game and came out of the game, and now it was 35 below in Delta. And as we got in the car, we had lost all the gears except for one. We only had reverse. So Marty immediately said, I'm going to call Dad. I said, oh, no, don't call your dad. I'm feeling like I'm supposed to be kind of the responsible person here. Don't call your dad. We're not going to call him. We're fine. We're fine. So it's no problem. So spent the night someplace and have some basketball family's friend's house and whatnot. The next morning at daylight, which is about 10, we backed out of Delta. I said, we can do this. Now think about this. When you're backing, you're on the wrong side of the road, so you're actually watching a berm as you're coming along, as you're backing along. So it's just pretty challenging. And so we, what we would do is about every 5 miles, we would trade. And somebody would you know, because you had to have the window open. In order, you had to have your head out the window looking as you're backing down the road. We got a couple of strange looks as we were going along, and we weren't making very good progress, but we were making progress. I said, don't worry, but we'll be fine. About halfway between Delta and Paxson, Paxson's about 80 miles south of Delta, we lost reverse. We didn't have cell phones, we didn't have phones, we had nothing. You know, so we say, well, we pull over this. Well, we were already at the side of the road, so we just stopped and without reverse. And not feeling bad at all about poor Willie's family's vehicle is now halfway between Delta and Paxson. So we decided we were going to hitchhike. We didn't really not ever hitchhike before. And in a small town in Valdez, I mean, who'd ever hitchhike? So the first car that comes along, I said, well, Marty, you hitchhike. I've just never hitchhiked. You hitchhike. A car would stop for you. And so the first car that came by, much to our surprise, and I mean, this probably wouldn't even happen today, but really back in 69, cars just always stop. The first car went by and didn't stop. And we looked at it and it had out-of-state license plates. We kind of go, oh, well, you know, it's out-of-state license plates. Okay. Wait about another hour and a half for another car to come by. I mean, that's not a very big, busy section of road. Another car came by. It didn't stop. And we're thinking, wow, another, and this was out of state as well. We thought, well, what's going on? And a lot of Alcan people, you know, driving up to Fairbanks or whatever, or down from Fairbanks, we figured that must be what it was. So the next car that came by and didn't stop, Marty just absolutely lost it. She, in the middle of the highway, she just screamed. She said, well, I won't say exactly what she said, but because she's still my deputy commissioner and she's still negotiating a gas line, but what she said, hey, what's wrong with you? He said, we might be somebody someday. And I looked at her and I said, Marty, what? Why would you say that? I mean, we're a couple of folks from Valdez who can't back our way from Delta to Valdez. Why would you think we would ever be somebody? And so finally, one stop, we got our way to Paxson Lodge, and we called her Dad. That was not a fun thing to do. Doggone it! We thought we were gonna make it all the way and didn't. So he, with a smile on his face, he just couldn't. I think he smiled all the way from Delta to Paxson and back, because you know here we had gone off to college. We had 6 months of education, and we could tackle the world. We could do anything, and obviously we couldn't. So the moral of my story is, don't back up. And if you feel like you have to, call for backup.
That was Governor Bill Walker from May 2015 at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts, and this has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show.
Thanks to our audio engineer from the Alaska Teen Media Institute, Kendall Stormo, and thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.